Rita had to do some tough work to convert Barney on some of these issues, so y'all should applaud her for that. So, okay, so again, back to a representation agreement. Can you somehow clean up this potential problem in a representation agreement?
Clearly. So, for instance, one of the things that is my standard language, and as Rita and I have discussed, I always go over it with the clients. In fact, it's the first paragraph in the representation agreement. It talks about the ethics. Actually, first, there's three paragraphs. And it gives me the authority to disclose their estate planning to people that are named in their documents. And are you okay with that? If they're not, we scratch it out. If they are, we keep it in. So I think an agreement can go a long way as long as...
As long as you have a consultation with them, they understand what it is they're consenting to.
So slight digression here, but I think it's important for what she just said. I have colleagues, and maybe some of you out here have representation agreements that are 5, 10, I've seen them 20 pages long, and boy, they cover everything. And in my opinion, the 20-page agreement that has 3 pages addressing this in meticulous detail from page 16 to page 19 is worthless.
Yeah.
It's worthless. My agreement is 2 pages long. I leave out all kinds of stuff. Well, actually, it's 2.5 now. I leave out all kinds of stuff I would like to address, but I can walk through the whole thing with a yellow marker with my clients, and then I feel like I've actually counseled them on it, and I feel like at least it's a chance of sticking. And I think that's something to consider.
Yeah, I think just relying on them reading it all probably won't count as having counseled them and knowing that they understand. So I agree with Barney. I think that you need to limit the writing, have a communication with them, interactive, so that you can see that they understand what you're talking about.
Okay, my favorite topic.
All right, so now we're going to move on to abuse. And so we have Dudley Manson telling you that sweet little Charlie Manson has been locking his 5-year-old in the laundry room. So, and Dudley says, don't tell anybody. What do you do?
This is what I learned from my wife. She is a licensed professional counselor, so she does mental health. And she was telling me, you know, privilege and confidentiality is interesting, Barney, but you know that you're required to report child abuse, elder abuse, abuse of disabled people. There's no privilege. There's no confidentiality. Do not pass go. Do not get out of jail free. You must tell no matter what. So the answer to that is a resounding B.
Can I just add that there is confidentiality, but there is an exception that allows you to reveal it, and you can reveal privileged information. That's under paragraph C4 of Rule 1.05 that says if you have a situation where you need to reveal confidential information either respond to an ethics rule, or if you have a court order, or if there is other law that requires you to reveal certain information, you have permission to reveal confidential, including privileged information, to comply with those requirements.
Very well said. Okay, so now we move on to another, Damien, who's married to Christina. Christina's a quadriplegic wheelchair user, arguably disabled. So Damien locks her in the laundry room when she is especially taxing and tells you not to tell anyone. I think this is pretty darn close to the last one.
Yeah, should be a no-brainer. The answer is B, you must contact the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services and report Damien. You agree?
Yeah, and if you, under this other law, if you're required to do that, then you certainly may reveal confidential information to do so.
So is there any way to draft this representation agreement so it will eliminate your obligation to report abuse?
Not only no, but...
I think a hell no is appropriate at this time of day on a Friday.
And client and law further agrees that attorney can violate these criminal statutes of Texas and not report abuse. No, can't be done.
Okay. So potentially incapacitated clients and guardianships. Whoop. Declining Edward. I really think there should be a movie named Declining Edward. It's sort of the life we live. So you start getting calls. He's lost his wife. He's making dramatic changes, specific changes to his will. CPA and financial planner are both on fire also, saying something is not working here. Should you talk to your client, Ed, and try to figure out what is going on with him?
I think yes. If you look to the DRs, there's a lot of rules in there that say if the attorney reasonably believes blah, 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 if the attorney has reason to be concerned, the first step in that is you pick up the phone and you talk to Ed.
I agree.
Okay. So you've done that. Can you call Ed's children and tell them what you know and say there's a problem with your dad?
So I think with both the children and with the agents under his attorney, in fact, his power of attorney, the issue there is you can make disclosures to a client when you believe they're incapacitated if you believe that there is a risk of them doing financial or personal harm to themselves. So my answer to question 23, can you contact the children, is not true or false. It's maybe depends.
So I think an earlier speaker touched on this new ethics rule that deals with clients who are incapacitated or suffering from a disability. I, for one, was very happy to see that rule passed. It's Disciplinary Rule 1.16, and it does a wonderful job of giving attorneys some leeway and some discretion in situations where you have a client that is suffering from a disability.